Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 29th of December. It is nice to be with you again. Spent a few days with my family. They're all asleep, and I'm not. But that's okay. They are. I'm sure they are. We want to thank John Munson and Glenn Moberg for filling in for me while I was spending time with my family this holiday time. The first hour of our program today, one of our favorite guests, he covers politics pretty darned astutely. Glenn Thrush covers Capitol Hill for Politico. He spent 5 years before that with Newsday, the last three in Washington, following Hillary Clinton's presidential quest with, as he says, a little Rudy Giuliani, Barack Obama, and Chuck Schumer thrown in. He is a veteran of Bloomberg News, former editor of City Limits, and he has written most recently, well, there's a lot to talk about. I haven't been with you to talk much about the lame duck Congress, which just ended, so we can certainly look at that. He writes an intriguing column about Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, saying that perhaps the White House and Democrats have finally found a crack in Fortress McConnell. We'll look at end-of-life care advanced directives. The president is doing an executive order on that, which has created some controversy. We will be looking at the next session of Congress and this spirit. Is there one of bipartisanship? Do you think this is a good thing or not? Bob Herbert wrote an interesting column yesterday about jobs, which is, you know, pretty depressing, saying more than 15 million Americans are officially classified as jobless. My question to the new Congress and to Glenn is, does anybody have a plan for creating jobs in America? We'll be welcoming phone calls. It will be nice to speak with you again, so feel free to call. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. Chrissy says, yes, you can. Yes, you can. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Glenn. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi, nice to have you here. Hope you had a good holiday.
And I did. Great to be here.
And that you will have a good new year. I know you're originally from Brooklyn. I have a stepson whose friends are having a hard time getting to feed his cat in Brooklyn because nobody can get anywhere, I guess.
No, it's crazy. I mean, this is, I have someone who lives really in the middle of Park Slope, which is a pretty major area in Brooklyn, and lives off the main thoroughfare. And it's 72 hours into this snowstorm, which is by no means the most severe storm that ever hit. And they're not moving.
This brings mayors down. I'm from Chicago.
Oh, absolutely. And in New York, this is going to be the end of Michael Bloomberg's national discussion for quite some time.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
Well, that is really hard to discern. I covered Mayor Bloomberg for 3 years and Rudy Giuliani for a couple of years prior to that. Michael Bloomberg, who obviously is a billionaire businessman, came into City Hall really with the mandate of running government as efficiently as Giuliani, but not as nasty, right? He really made it a point to handle these crises and really was sort of obsessed about crisis management for the first couple of years. Dealt with a blackout very well and a succession of other sort of snowstorms and other mini disasters. And what happened last year is his trusted deputy mayor for operations, a guy by the name of Ed Schuyler, left to be replaced by former mayor of Indianapolis, Goldsmith.
Oh.
And it just seems as if the level of attentiveness to these details has not been quite as great.
Wow. Well, this is a big one. This is really inconveniencing many, many people.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there's the famous late 60s snowstorm with John Lindsay in New York that really became, emblematic of a larger inability to control the city. Bloomberg isn't really, this is not going to take Bloomberg's reputation down, but I think it really has accentuated some of this latent hostility towards him, particularly in the high-handed way that he kind of deals with people. I mean, the New York Daily News, sort of a dominant tabloid in New York, is reporting today that, you know, an infant died waiting for an ambulance for 9 hours.
Oh, no.
I mean, that's not the kind of thing that New Yorkers tend to take sitting down.
So. No, nobody should take that sitting down. That's terrible. All right, on to the lame duck session of Congress. What's the story? Is everybody getting along swimmingly now?
More like a convergence, and this was really unexpected. I mean, this is why this is fun to cover, because everyone predicted that this was going to be the lamest of lame ducks. In fact, I, like every other reporter in Washington, was sort of pressured by my bosses to write a story about how lousy this was going to be. and I have to say, it really took people by surprise. And the reason why so much was accomplished, the middle-class tax cut deal, the passage of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the START Treaty, and even the 9/11 First Responders Bill, is because it was in everybody's interest to cut deals. Now the question is, will that environment persist into 2011? That is an unknown. But the Republicans, and this was really the missing piece that I think most people didn't really understand going to the lame duck, the Republicans, particularly in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, had a great incentive to be perceived, at least for a short period of time, as being willing to be conciliatory to the White House, because we're about, I think, to enter at least 3 months of intensely partisan combat, and Republicans are going to need to say that they have at least made an effort to reach out to the president. But it is a very interesting dynamic, and shows you just how unpredictable things are.
Right. And the 3 months of intensely partisan conflict will be on what issues, Glenn?
Spending, spending, and spending. I mean, the House Democrats, led by Speaker to be John Boehner, have said that they will focus primarily on cutting budget items to deal with the deficit. In fact, there's been some reports out over the last couple of days that they're about to rewrite the House rules, kind of amazingly, saying exempting tax cuts from sort of pay-go deficit rules, which is just sort of an astounding thing for them to do in a time of historic deficits, and saying only spending cuts would be really considered for deficit reduction. So this is going to set up a classic Republican and Democratic fight, and really put the pressure on President Obama and Democrats in the Senate to defend entitlement programs. And that is a position that Republicans are really, really looking forward to. So you're going to see battles on sort of a reopening of the omnibus spending package, which was defeated in the Senate during the lame duck, which Republicans considered a great victory. You're going to see a huge fight over this $13 trillion debt ceiling that's going to be coming up in January or February, which could actually divide the Republicans. And you're going to see this attempt to repeal en masse health care reform. So this is going to be 3 months of politicking.
Mm-hmm. We have Wendell Potter with us, the second hour of our program today, who has said some interesting things about health care reform, that it would behoove politically the Republicans, who receive a whole lot of money more than Democrats from the health insurance industry, to take on this issue. But everybody's in the health insurance industry's pocket, so they'll make a show of it. But once those lobbyists descend en masse on the new Congress, forget it. There's not going to be a repeal.
No, there's not going to be a repeal, frankly, because it's so complicated, and a lot of these deals are some of the best deals that industry is going to get.
Mm-hmm.
The granddaddy of them all is the big pharma deal that was cut between the drug companies and Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff of the White House, which, by the way, the Republican Congress is going to investigate a bit, along with the cooperation of Henry Waxman, the former Democratic head of the Health Committee. But the whole notion of health care reform remains extraordinarily polarizing. There was a somewhat surprising poll out a couple of days ago that showed 60% of Americans oppose the individual mandate. That's been at variance with some other recent polling that shows individual parts of the health care reform bill are pretty popular. So I think what you're going to start seeing is really targeted, after the Republicans pass in the House, pass their repeal, and it dies in the Senate. You're going to see targeted attacks on the health care reform, really based on polling and focus group.
Mm-hmm.
So, attacking individual components of the health reform bill. And I think the White House really needs to spend, and we haven't heard anything out of them on this, I think they need to spend a significant part of their communications thinking on rebranding healthcare reform and reselling it to the American people, because the goodies are starting to pile up. You're gonna see the extension of benefits to young people who live with their parents over the age of 26, and you're going to start seeing this pre-existing health condition stuff. And this is the way it was designed, to have the fun stuff up front and then have the complex stuff phased in at 2013. So if the White House, you know, whiffed on the first opportunity to sell this to the American people, I mean, they need to do a much better job in 2011 or they're going to get creamed on it in 2012.
Mm-hmm. That individual mandate, though, is going to help insurance companies enormously, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And then the insurance companies love it. And that's where you hit the nail on the head. I mean, Republicans are going to be bucking some of their funding base on this. And remember, the AMA signed on with all this as well. And you even have people like Mitt Romney, you know, the former governor of Massachusetts and a hopeful for the 2012 Republican primary, twisting in the wind on this because, you know, he was responsible for the individual mandates implementation in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
So this has become sort of an orthodoxy of the Republican right wing. And as you know, the Republican right wing now controls the primary. So you now have sort of the larger interests of the Republican money base at variance with the Republican, sort of the Tea Party-tinged conservative wing of the Republican Party. And this is, and that is exactly the kind of conflict that the White House is, mm-hmm. is looking forward to stoke.
If there's a way to get a handle on what the American people think about how they want Congress to govern, do you think that Congress, the lame duck, was given very high marks that we were saying this is what we want? Because simultaneously, the president has been receiving, you know, a lot of criticism from his base, particularly on the tax cut bill. But are most people saying, skip the base of the Republican Party, skip the base of the Democratic Party? We like what we saw.
Well, look, people are going to – I always take a lot of flack for this. But the core of the Democratic base on the left is essentially intact for President Obama. And, in fact, I saw some polling today out of MSNBC, I think, showing that President Obama, in terms of his core support among progressives, is right around 78%, 21% higher than Bill Clinton was at a comparable point in his presidency. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of chatter on the left, and there's a lot of passion on the left, and a lot of disappointment. But at the end of the day, President Obama still enjoys rock-solid support from progressives, and that's just a fact. And that is what allowed him to maneuver to the center in the lame duck, and that's going to give him a lot of latitude. So far from, I think, being a liability for the president pulling him backwards, I think he has a mandate from progressives, and a sense also, by the way, there was a lot of hue and cry during the lame duck session from House leadership, Nancy Pelosi, George Miller, Henry Waxman, and liberals in the Senate, Sherrod Brown and others, over these compromises. And that hue and cry, with the exception of sort of Bernie Sanders' filibuster attempt, has largely faded. So I think there is an acceptance, much as there was with George W. Bush, with the Republican base, of the fact that Obama needs to tack towards the middle in order to get reelected. So I do think this angle has been overplayed a bit.
Let's talk about these jobless numbers, because I keep waiting for somebody, and a lot of people do, to do something about the enormously high number of people. I guess it's more than 15 million
Amazing.
People,
yeah.
according to this study done at Rutgers. Over the past 15 months, the surveys have been conducted. One quarter of the workers have found full-time jobs, nearly all of them for less pay and with fewer
yep.
or no benefits. Somebody has to do something about this, or they're going to say a pox on both your houses.
Oh, exactly. And I think a pox on both your parties as well, right?
Right.
I mean, in terms of the jobless numbers, that's why I think the discussion about any one technical aspect of where things are headed politically is fundamentally irrelevant. I mean, the jobless numbers are really the key. Now the president, I think in 10 of the 11 months of this year, there has been private sector job creation. 1 million jobs have been created in this country in the past 12 months, right? Which is, I think, the largest number for any single year in 15 or 18 years, which in any other environment which would be considered an achievement. But that is 1 million out of 15 million lost since the Great Recession began, according to some statistics. So even though the president can point to forward momentum and the end of the year seems to have augured in some increased momentum on retail sales, things are looking really bleak. And really the only thing that the American people give a damn about at this point our jobs. I was watching an HBO documentary recently of the 2008 campaign that I just thought was really stunning. And I think this illustrates President Obama's weakness on this issue and where he needs to improve. They got cameras into a 2008 debate prep with Obama and his advisors. This is prior to one of the final debates with John McCain in 2008. And President Obama then Senator Obama had four bullet points he needed to hit, and he ticked them off perfectly. And then he turns to his advisors and he says, "There's a fourth bullet point. What was it? What was it?" And then he says, "Jobs."
Oh my gosh!
And that has been, I think, the fundamental problem of this administration. It's been perceived behind health care and other and regulatory reform as being an afterthought, and it can't be an afterthought anymore.
No. What's the name of the documentary? Do you remember?
I don't remember what it was, but it's HBO's big documentary, all-access documentary on the 08 campaign.
Oh, good. Okay. We'll have to see that.
An amazing, real stunning moment that in the context of his problems now.
What's the fourth? Hey, how about the first? Let's go to Robin. We'll go to phone calls. We have a ton of them who's on the road. Hi, Robin.
Hi. I'm calling because I feel that we should get rid of this oil altogether. I'm 50 years old. I've been listening to this. I know that the inventions were in Madison when I was 13. I'm tired of it. Why can't we put our engineers together, take our sewer lines, turn them into methane gas, heat our homes with it, get rid of oil, do solar, have clean air. We won't have kids with all this asthma. We will put our engineers to work. We'll have our factories full again. We'll put our people back to work using our money in that way. And I'll take that off the air. Thank you.
All right. And that was supposed to be the area of big growth, a green economy.
Well, there was $80 billion in the stimulus for green jobs, and this is not something that's going to pop up right away. There's a lot of seed money and tax credits, and a lot of that, according to some recent reporting, particularly by the Los Angeles Times and others, hasn't been spent. So, this is an administration that actually has made a pretty significant contribution to green jobs, and they've backed off some of the offshore exploration permitting that they had alluded to earlier in this year. But the caller is fundamentally right. I mean, Copenhagen was a failure last year at the climate talks. The UN talks in Mexico this year were an afterthought. They were a joke. Most news organizations didn't even bother sending anybody. And there really is no structure in place for any approach to global warming. And in his end of the year press conference, that was the one area that President Obama identified as his greatest disappointment.
Glenn Thrush, our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. He covers Capitol Hill for Politico and is a guest frequently, and a good guest, I might add, on our program. We're welcoming phone calls. Our lines have been humming, but there will be an opening eventually for you. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. Chrissy looked up the documentary, and it is titled By the People, The Election of Barack Obama. That'd be a good show for us, too. We could talk with the documentary makers about that film after we've seen it. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Wednesday, Wendell Potter will be joining us. That name I'm sure is familiar to many of you. He is the one who blew the whistle on the health insurance industry. His book is Deadly Spin, and insurance company insiders speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Let's go to more phone calls. Lou is next in Cudahy. Hi, Lou.
Good morning. Thank you for a good show. Obama was taught that America is a colonialist empire and a world superpower, and for that we need to be punished. So he's doing that right now. He's helping us commit economic warfare against ourselves. Last week I filled up my car with gas for $3.09 a gallon, and now Ken Salazar, that buffoon that wears the cowboy hats, he's now stopped drilling on the eastern seaboard on the continental shelf. We stopped drilling on the the Gulf area. So now we're seeing predictions of gas up to $5 a gallon. That is economic warfare committed by the president. And also, government does not create jobs and wealth. The private industry, private sector needs to create wealth. That's what they do. And he's got this ongoing war against the private sector because he has contempt for capitalism. He hates the private sector and thinks government is the answer to everything. This is a sign of a guy who has a real problem with liberty, freedom, and free market capitalism. That's why the Tea Party candidates were elected in November, and that is to stop the Obama agenda. It's against this country. Real simple.
Lou, don't you have a problem, though, with that huge oil spill in the Gulf that destroyed the Gulf for a period of time? Doesn't that need to be regulated?
The Gulf has not been destroyed. It's on the rebound. And secondly, the industry has been given fair warning, fair notice that they better bring their safety standards way up. But the idea that we should shut down commerce and industry, that's leftist. And that's what they've done. They've used the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, to shut down commerce and industry because they have contempt for capitalism. They just don't like it. And, you know,
they want to keep some of the species around.
Everything that America does, we have to be brought down to, you know, the new norm now is 10% unemployment. That's acceptable? Baloney.
All right, Glenn.
Well, where to begin?
I don't know.
First of all, a couple of things. I don't know of any economist that would identify exploration on the continental shelf in these particular areas, because remember, he has allowed areas in other parts apart from the eastern seaboard. I guess it was an executive order that was issued earlier in the year. Still applies to vast oil fields. I don't know of any individual economists, maybe the caller can point me to them, who cites the recent spike in gas and oil prices to the exploration issue. I think it has to do with stockpiles, and it also has to do with the foreign underproduction based on commodities prices. The second issue in terms of the president's, I've heard this anti-capitalism, socialism argument for the president. I'm not defending the administration's policies on this, but I think that is a facile characterization. I mean, you're dealing with a president who just, I believe, is part of this package in the tax cuts. There are $300 billion of tax incentives for business, including a 2% payroll tax cut, and all sorts of incentives for business investment, including the green stuff. So the notion that he is entirely oppositional to large industry is, I think, on its face untrue. In addition, I mean, we referred to the deal that they cut with Big Pharma on the healthcare reform stuff, which has been criticized by many on the left. So, I really just think this kind of extreme rhetoric about the president in either direction doesn't really help the debate very much.
What about his ideas that the private sector creates jobs, the government does not create jobs? That's been a big part of the debate the last year or so. Who's responsible for creating jobs? And there were many economists who said the government really needs to step in a lot more than they did.
Well, it's really interesting, sort of the argument, again, over the extension of the tax cuts, switched very rapidly from a question about sort of taxpayer equity from wealthy to middle class to working class into one of economic stimulus. You had Larry Summers all of a sudden popping out of the blue, claiming that, you know, not passing this would have caused a double dip recession. I think the question, apart from sort of asking the question whether or not government and the private sector can create jobs, I think it's a useful exercise to look back at who destroyed the jobs, and I think, you know, the interpretation of American history that I think is most on point is that, you know, it's this conversation, sometimes argument between the private sector and government in terms of regulation, tax policy, and monetary supply. I think to sort of say that either the government or the public sector is individually responsible for the creation or destruction of jobs just doesn't make any sense. I think it has to do, and again, this is not my opinion, this is sort of consensus of economists, has to do with sort of that conversation. Now, I think even the Obama folks would admit that the amount of government stimulus and the amount of government hiring has gone in an uncomfortable direction for them. And that's why you're seeing, for instance, things that are so far token, like this three-year discretionary non defense spending freeze that was announced at the last State of the Union,
yes,
and also this capping of the capping of government hiring. So,
right,
while there's a recognition that the government may have stepped in a bit too much during a time of crisis, I think there is still a sense that if they pull back too quickly, we might double dip.
Mike in Oshkosh, hi.
Yeah, good morning. Bob Bixby of the Concord Coalition wrote an op-ed this week suggesting that obviously we're facing this catastrophic failure if we don't address the debts, the huge deficits we have. And he points to the three key players, of course, the president, and then there's Kent Conrad, who heads the budget committee in the Senate. And then we've got our own Paul Ryan here, who's going to be taking on the budget committee in the House. I'm wondering if the guest with his inside baseball perspective there in Washington sees Paul Ryan as being largely distracted with the meteoric rise he's getting of late and potentially running for president. Is he going to be able to compromise, or is he going to be smitten with the run for 2012?
Well, I think it's a good question. I don't, Ryan is not running in 2012. I don't think he has the infrastructure. I don't think he's got the name recognition, but he's clearly rising in his party. I mean, the problem with Paul Ryan is that he is a little bit too honest in terms of being prescriptive. I mean, he is one of the few figures in either party who have specifically called for entitlement reform. And attacking the issue at the root, which is sort of the exploding cost of Medicare and Social Security, and he has been a one-man band on that. And the funny thing about it is President Obama respects Ryan, I think, more than probably any other member of the House Republican Conference, apart from Fred Upton. I think. I think the bigger question about Ryan is whether or not he sort of follows political convention, which he has shown a capacity to flout from time to time, or whether or not he sort of continues down this increasingly lonely road along with the deficit commission in terms of challenging conventional wisdom. I don't recall what his specific response to the deficit commission proposals were, but I think he was a little wishy-washy.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Don in Madison, hi.
Good morning.
Hello.
We're in a demand crisis, and instrumental in that, of course, is unemployment. And I was thinking about the unemployment benefits that have just been voted, and that's giving people money, but not asking them to do anything in return. I don't object to it. I think it's a good idea because it keeps the demand schedule up a little bit. But there's an alternative to that, and that's to counteract laying off teachers, firemen, policemen, whatever, employees of counties and states, having the federal government begin a program to keep those people in employment, because you'd be paying them to do something that people need. How about that?
How about that, Glenn?
Well, under the stimulus, the federal government did subsidize sort of the hiring of teachers and other municipal employees, and we're starting to see that hand being removed, and you're seeing, a loss, I think, and I'm throwing this figure out there based on my recollection, of about 500,000 municipal employees nationwide as a result of the removal of this federal aid. I mean, I think those kinds of programs where you tie benefits, particularly benefits that people have paid into. I mean, that's the difference between unemployment insurance and welfare, for instance. I mean, even though people are on these sort of endless extensions that are fundamentally just federal money, the program is an insurance program, and people have paid into these programs for years and years and years. So that makes it, I think, a little bit different. I think at this point in time, given the time frame, given the desperation of folks, sort of engineering a program on the fly that sort of links this kind of work up to people's unemployment insurance would be really difficult. And in addition, I think, it just costs much, much more to pay somebody to work in some of these places. And would you be driving down the salaries of teachers who are already on the job and in places with a unionized municipal workforce? would that create litigation? I think it's a very, very difficult thing to do. But I can tell you this. I mean, in terms of pure stimulus, unemployment insurance is at the top of the heap. That money goes directly back into the economy. People spend it to live. And it is regarded, at least by the economists in the White House, as being the most effective stimulus.
Thank you, John, for the call. We'll get back to the economy in a moment. Let's spend a few moments on end-of-life issues and the president signing, I guess it was a directive or whatever you call it, the calling for voluntary end-of-life counseling. This was, as everybody recalls, a big part of the healthcare debate, Sarah Palin coining this term, death panels. And is this going to be a controversial issue? And why isn't this one? It seems to me as though it merits more conversation. The governor of Arizona, who's deciding that certain transplants are not to be paid for by Medicaid, isn't that a death panel?
Well, you raise a really good point. I mean, the difference between this right now and the last time we were talking about this, and I think it was Palin picked up on it, but it was Betsy McCoy Ross, a former lieutenant governor in New York, who really put this thing out.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. I think the difference between then and now is the health care bill has been passed already. And I think the death panel injecting that into the debate, and by the way, the death panel thing has been regarded by PolitiFact and some of these other rating organizations as being false. I just think the environment has become less charged on this. And also, I think the way that this is being presented as a voluntary rather than compulsory compulsory add-on has kind of cooled it down. And when you sort of look at the merits of this, you know, if a person has an end-of-life diagnosis, offering them potential funding to be able to cope with that, you know, as kind of a multivalent problem, I think makes a lot of sense to a lot of people when you break it down. So I think, you know, it being pulled out of the political context of the healthcare debate is going to be helpful for people who support it. And the other thing about it is, you know, we're getting to the age of a la carte politics here and niche politics. So I think you're going to see a lot of fundraising off of this on the right wing. It's kind of drifting as an issue. As an issue strictly for the right, as opposed to being a mainstream issue.
But isn't there something? It's stuck in my mind here because this, and you see it during the. It strikes you more during the holidays. This huge gap between, you know, people who have during the holidays and people who are at homeless shelters that are packed with people and they don't have jobs, et cetera. When you look at this healthcare thing, there's something fundamentally disturbing about this to me. That if you're on Medicaid, you can't get a certain kind of operation that will save your life. If you're not poor, you can get that. Isn't there something wrong with that?
Yeah, and I think these are some of the issues that that I think the president hopes to deal with if and when healthcare reform is phased in 2013. And but you know, I mean, politically, these issues of equity are just not big sellers for Democrats. And I mean, it's just one of the undeniable facts in American life in the last 15 years is this incredible skewing of income distribution, right?
Yes.
I mean, we've seen great gains for the top 1% in terms of income, and stagnation and backtracking in terms of the larger middle class. This just does not seem to be, and Politico's written a lot about this recently, just does not seem to be an issue in terms of these class issues that Americans get really passionate about. Maybe that'll change over the next year or so, but it just, you know, it's an issue Democrats don't like to talk about this because they get accused by Republicans of chatting up class warfare. But, you know, it is a fundamental task for the Democratic Party and for President Obama to kind of get middle-class people and working-class people in a coalition so that they sort of view themselves as being allied. And to some extent that, that involves asking these larger questions about income distribution. You heard a lot of it in 2000 and during the 2007 and 2008 primary and general election campaigns, but it really has just completely dropped off the radar since.
Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Holidays.
Thank you. You too.
Excellent program, excellent guest. I would like to ask you about a couple of things that came out yesterday. One was the former Shell executive talking about seeing no end in sight for the escalation in the price of crude oil and and therefore gas, and the which seemed to catch everybody by surprise, the dip in consumer confidence. Now, I heard somebody a while back saying that you can correlate really frighteningly closely the price of gasoline and consumer confidence, and it sort of makes sense in that, you know, when we go into these periods where the you just see it going up and up, and you, and people like the Shell executive are saying, hey, no end in sight, coupled with the fact that the rest of the world, you know, India, China, Brazil, Russia, all seem to be bouncing back in overdrive and pushing up demand not only for crude oil but for all kinds of resources, doesn't this bode very, very ill for any kind of recovery for this country and the political prospects? And, you know, for two of these first callers have, what was the first caller calling about? The gas prices, and another one about the gas prices. And now me, you know, it is one of those things, I think, and frankly, you know, the speculation that goes on, you know, it's sort of like this little of feeding frenzy among the sharks. You know, can we raise it up more? Can we raise it up more? Sure, we can raise it up more. And and I personally, and I'm going on way too long here, but I personally subscribe to the theory that what really touched off the great fall, the great recession a couple years back, was when they pushed the prices over $4 a gallon, and all those people who had high mortgages and were leveraged to the hilt in the first place suddenly had to choose between buying gas to commute to work or maybe paying this month's mortgage payment, and, well, something had to give. What do you think?
Well, I think that is an amazingly on point, particularly the correlation between consumer confidence and gas prices. I mean, when you think about it, you are, you know, subliminally and not so subliminally subjected to the ups and downs of these fluctuations when you're driving along a road. I mean, what other economic index hits you in the face every time you're in your car? And it's not just at the pump. It's just a sign that things are not moving in the right direction. I think, you know, perversely, a lot of policymakers think that the rise in gas prices is probably a good thing long term because it'll divert us from the dependence on oil. You know, it's obviously we're about to embark on this very, very tough fight in Congress over the EPA greenhouse, the carbon monoxide emissions, which Democrats have been really fearing. You know, I think to a certain extent, when you're seeing these high gas prices, that's a little bit of wind at the back of Democrats and people who are looking for these reforms. But I think the caller makes a tremendous tremendous point that I haven't really seen explored sufficiently.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, how often have we heard this song before? Though this is finally going to make us divert our dependence on oil. We're going to finally, because of this, decide to do something about it. We've been playing that refrain for years.
It's amazing. I mean, you ride around, you listen to sort of local radio in the Washington, D.C. area, and, you know, and I was down in North Carolina, same thing. You know, all of a sudden people are selling the SUVs again. It's just like, literally, the price goes up or down by 40, 50 cents. People make
it's
these
wacky
major lifestyle changes.
I know, it's just, All right, thank you, Scott, as always, for your insights. We go to Mark in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. The last session of Congress, Dennis Kucinich introduced a bill to give us full employment. It's called the NEED Act. I don't know exactly what it stands for, but the reason we're in the trouble that we're in is because of this huge deficit. So everybody talks about the deficit, how are we going to pay for it, but they don't address the issue of monetary policy. And so Kucinich's bill addresses monetary policy by way of bringing the money issuing power back into the Treasury away from the private bank of the Fed and issuing currency without any debt. It is the debt that is the second largest expense in our budget, but the debt is because we're borrowing our currency into existence. The currency need not be borrowed into existence, and the debt doesn't even need to exist if we would issue currency as a function of government instead of borrow currency and in debt the country in the process. Kucinich plan you can find on a website called monetary.org. And I think that until the American people really understand that the function of their currency as a debt instrument has been the downfall of the economy. Ron Paul, who interestingly is on the other side of the political spectrum, as Dennis Kucinich, they both get it, and they both are going to do something about monetary policy in this country. But I guarantee you that the banks on both sides of the aisle will try to sideline both of these gentlemen, and yet they are right on in terms of what the problem is. It's monetary policy that is driving virtually everything, and this debt multiplies regardless of what's going on in the spending.
Glenn.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on monetary policy, thank God. But I think a couple of things are. I think the caller makes a point speaking about sort of the role that the Fed played in terms of the recession. I think there is a widespread belief right now that keeping interest rates as low as Alan Greenspan did for much of the past decade. Really fueled the speculative bubble in commercial and residential real estate. So to that extent, I think the there's a clear line between the mess that we're in and the Fed's actions. I think it's less clear, and I think the jury is still out about the role that Ben Bernanke's been playing in terms of the quantitative easing and the so-called QE2 round of $600 billion more being pumped into the system. We're starting to see some funky stuff going on with Treasury auctions over the last couple of days. But a lot of economists say that the fact that we can print our own money and sort of spend our way through some of these rough patches is actually a benefit and keeps us out of the kind of trouble that you're seeing with the sovereign debt crisis in Europe. I know that the Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich views on the Fed are gaining traction, but my sense from talking with economists and reading is that this is a fairly complex system, and that the consensus is that the jury is out.
Glenn Thrush, our guest this hour, covers Capitol Hill for Politico. Our phone number, thanks, Mark, for your call. One line open at 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Wednesday, Wendell Potter will be joining us. Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider, and that's Wendell, in case you're not familiar with him. I'm sure most of you are quite familiar with him, speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Wendell is now the senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy, and he left his job, which was a top-notch executive position at Cigna. He also worked for Humana. He left his job in 2008 for a number of reasons, and he is now an outspoken critic of America's health insurance industry. It will be particularly, the last time we interviewed him was before healthcare reform took place. I'm interested in what he thinks of what was finally passed and whether or not there will be a repeal of parts of healthcare reform and what those parts that will be under scrutiny will be. All right, let's go to phone calls. More of them for Glenn Thrush. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we go next to Sandy from Algoma. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Kathleen. I wanted to thank you for having this conversation. I think it's great. I also wanted to say that I agree wholeheartedly with the gentleman that was on just before about getting rid of the Fed. I think that would improve things so much. But above all, I wanted to say that I would really love to see somebody leading the way on trying to knock back our military spending and our the forms of imperialism that we are using. There are now almost 1,000 military bases on foreign soil. And the one in Okinawa has 49,000 people. How insane is that? And our tax dollars are paying for it. And you cannot convince me that is not what's bankrupting this country. So like almost close to $1 trillion a year that we're spending on military spending. And, we got these wars going on. It's nuts.
Glenn, do we have that many military bases? 1,000?
I think so.
Wow, that's a lot, isn't it?
I can count them now, but huh. I mean, this is going to be a huge, I think, issue for Democrats in the House and Senate, particularly in the House, as they sort of face this wall of Republicans who are looking to cut domestic programs and entitlements. And I think the White House is acutely aware of this, and this is a big driver. Don't kid yourself on the Afghan and Iraq policies. I mean, we need to cut costs, and you can cut costs in the magnitude of $10, $20, $40, $60 billion in fairly broad strokes by hitting defense spending. I mean, it is a measure of the degree to which the Pentagon feels threatened. That Secretary Gates a few months ago proposed pretty broad cuts in some vehicle purchase programs and even some new weapons systems. And it was also, I think, pretty instructive that you saw a guy like George Voinovich, the retiring Republican senator from Ohio, join in with some Democrats over the last couple of years to sort of decry the expansion of the military in terms of the money. I think this is an issue that's just going to continue to creep up on both Democrats and Republicans, particularly as these numbers for support of the war in Afghanistan continue to plummet.
Well, and the war in Afghanistan, what attention will be paid to that in the coming year? This has gone on for such a long period of time. I don't think most Americans are paying a whole lot of attention to it, and I think that not a whole lot has happened there in terms of making the country a safer place. It just seems to be a morass.
Well, that is really, I mean, that is, you know, you can't even get a consistently straight answer out of the White House for what the objectives are in Afghanistan in the course of a single day any longer. Mm. I mean, we just had the AFPAC review over the last couple of weeks, and you had White House Secretary Robert Gibbs say that this was an occasion for a reassessment of what the White House plans to do. And a couple of weeks earlier than that, you had sort of administration officials in a conference call with reporters saying that it wouldn't be an assessment. And as it turned out, it really wasn't a very significant assessment. I think you have a lot of discordant voices within the administration about the direction to go in. And I think what is most alarming is the game seems to have moved on, particularly to Yemen and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and this increasing focus, I think, of these safe havens in Pakistan. I mean, it really is this classic whack-a-mole that you do a drone strike or a boots-on-the-ground operation or a secure and hold operation in a place like southern Afghanistan, and then you have a flare-up quite alarmingly in the north, as has occurred in the past couple of months. Now, and the point that you raise is really the salient one here, is, you know, people don't like this war, but the level of passion about not liking this war isn't anywhere near what people felt for Iraq, much less Vietnam. So, you know, until sort of the public passion over this sort of rises, the Obama administration is going to have a fair amount of latitude in terms of discerning a policy. But I have to tell you, the reaction on the Hill to the recent noises about this going on in Afghanistan, a significant military operation to 2014, have been very negative. And I think one of the real things to watch in the new year is skepticism from Republicans, particularly on the Tea Party end. This might be one of those rare opportunities where you see the two wings of the House of Representatives, the 80 to 90 progressives, and the 50 to 70 Tea Party folks may be ganging up and coming up with something appearing to be consensus, because I think the war is increasingly unpopular and the financial burdens of it are going to only continue to compound.
Mm-hmm. We have a little less than a minute left, but I think we can take this call. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
I say all goes back to resources, because to have freedom, you need knowledge, you need self-control, but you need resources. And if you let 1% of the country own all the resources, they're not going to be very free. Also, if you have too many resources, the stuff owns you. You're most free is when you have just enough to do what you want to do.
Just enough to do what you want to do. Our wish for everybody in the new year. That makes sense, doesn't it, Glenn?
Well, particularly the self-control part. I mean, I'd like to see there be a United States Department of Self-Control, right? That would be completely unfunded.
There you go. We'll take up that campaign. We'll take up that campaign. Well, Glenn, I think that you really are just so well informed, and you're a marvelous guest. I hope you'll join us frequently in, what is it going to be, 2011?
Yeah.
Whoa! Thank you so much. Thanks for all of your insights.
Well, thank you.
Glenn Thrush, our guest this hour. He covers Capitol Hill for Politico. He was with Newsday before that. He covered Hillary Rodham Clinton's presidential quest. And he was also in the basement of New York City Hall, where he annoyed, he says, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and is a veteran of Bloomberg News, former editor of City Limits. He's really a good guest, don't you think? Well, that takes care of the first hour. It just flew on by. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production. I do want to remind you that you can join us on Facebook, and you don't have to be a Facebook member to go to our Facebook page. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and more you're starting to write comments and responding to guests, and that's what it's for, and that's all good. So we hope that you will continue. News coming up from National Public Radio and Wendell Potter following that, so please stay with us.